Joining me on the telephone now from Santiago, Chile, is Sebastian Brett. Sebastian, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Thanks for being with us today. Sebastian works with Human Rights Watch. He's a researcher for the Andean region. Sebastian, we want to spend most of our conversation today talking about Peru and the recent resignation of President Fujimori and, of course, the flight of Vladimiro Montesinos, who is the spy chief, not official, but always has had a bit of an unofficial role in the Peruvian government for many years, and somebody who has attracted a lot of curiosity. We will talk about that very shortly, but first I wanted to ask you to bring us up to date on the situation in Chile in what regards the judgment or the process, the judicial process, against former dictator Augusto Pinochet.
Right.
What can you tell us? We know that October 9th was a date that had been set for the questioning of Augusto Pinochet by Judge Guzman. Has that changed?
Well, it looks like the date's been set back because Judge Guzman has now finally decided to have some medical tests done on General Pinochet, which he is actually obliged to do by law. But the timing of this was not clear, and it's now clear that he's going to do those tests before he actually questions Pinochet. And it's conceivable, though I think unlikely, but it's conceivable that on the basis of those tests, simply he could reach the conclusion that Pinochet was not fit to stand trial.
What is your sense of what the reaction would be to that, given what has happened in the last couple of days in Indonesia, with Suharto being excused, also for medical reasons, from being tried, and of course the situation in the streets of Indonesia is very, very tense and very violent.
Right.
What do you think would happen in Santiago or in Chile?
Well, frankly, I think it's unlikely that Judge Guzman would actually rule that Pinochet was unfit to stand trial on the basis of the kind of test that he's required to run by law, because the Chilean law is actually quite strict in the circumstances in which it says that somebody is not fit to stand trial on medical grounds. And strictly speaking, the only grounds that are relevant here is if Pinochet is actually declared to be insane or so sick mentally, I'm saying, in such a bad state mentally that he simply can't, be held responsible for his actions.
Right. And this process is...
I think that's very unlikely on the basis of the medical reports that we know that exist up to the present.
Now, this questioning would happen in the context of a case known as the Caravan of Death. Can you tell us briefly about that case and what step in the process it's at right now?
Well, the Caravan of Death, as you probably know, was a military operation conducted on Pinochet's orders in October 1973, in which more than 70 prisoners were taken out of jail and summarily executed. Pinochet, this is one of the human rights crimes which Pinochet is most directly implicated, because this group was acting on his orders. And many of the officials involved subsequently went on to occupy important roles in the DINA, which is the Pinochet's secret police, subsequently. Now, Pinochet is actually accused of having commanded this operation, having given orders for this operation. And the crime is kidnapping. As you probably know, the Supreme Court has ruled that kidnapping... If the fate of the victims has not been clarified and it's not been possible to establish that they were actually killed, the meaning of that is that the crime would not be covered by the amnesty law.
So
essentially, there's been a loophole which has enabled this case to go forward against Pinochet.
Thank you for that, Sebastian. We'd like to turn now to the issue of Peru. We saw the resignation or the announcement that Alberto Fujimori, the president of Peru, will not run in the elections that he is now calling for. We're not sure, we're not clear as to when those elections might take place. We understand that President Fujimori is in Washington as we speak, negotiating, one presumes, with the Organization of American States and with the United States, perhaps. He was able to secure fleeing of his spy chief to Panama. I understand that Panama had actually rejected having Vladimiro Montesinos go and seek asylum there initially, and that they have accepted him to go there. What do you know about this situation? What's the latest news on this?
Well, I think that the President Moscoso of Panama is still to make a decision, finally, on whether to grant Montesinos asylum. And what is quite clear is that there's a very strong current of opinion in Panama, which is absolutely against this, coupled with the fact that this has drawn very strong criticism from not only the Peruvian opposition, but also all of the most well-known international human rights organization have protested about the action of the OAS, its role in trying to get Montesinos asylum in Panama. And so I think there is a lot of pressure on President Moscoso to actually turn that down, although one has to say that the U.S. Government has strongly backed this kind of solution to the Peruvian crisis, if it is indeed a solution.
Is it in fact a crisis? What is the sense there as the Andean region's Human Rights Watch researcher? What is your sense of what has happened over the last 10 days or so and the impact that it potentially could have or the impact that it is having on the region as a whole?
Well, I think as far as Peru is concerned, the thing that the incident that detonated this whole crisis, which was the revelation of this video in which a spy chief, Montesinos, was actually depicted, seen offering a bribe to a congressman to persuade him to change sides. I think that this event was, the revelation of that video, was one of two incidents which have really changed the situation fundamentally in Peru. The other, of course, was possible involvement of the Peruvian army, sectors of the Peruvian army and intelligence service in arms trafficking to the Colombian guerrilla,
yes.
Which clearly is, if those allegations are substantiated, is an extremely serious action which threatened to destabilize the situation in the whole region.
Indeed.
But basically, I think what we're seeing now is the unraveling of Fujimori's power in Peru. And quite ironically, I think that the fact that Montesinos is now in Panama has really brought home very sharply just how dependent Fujimori was on Montesinos and how relatively adrift he's become since Montesinos is no longer there to shore up the regime. And what it looks like is doing is that Montesinos is now appealing to the OAS and the international community to shore up his government against what appears to be possibly a military insurrection on the part of army officers who are still loyal to Montesinos and were actually installed in power by him over the last couple of years or so.
What about his role specifically over the last 10 years in this government? We know that he's been involved with this government from the very beginning. What can you tell us from the perspective of Human Rights Watch, that the role that Montesinos has played directly when it comes to human rights violations in Peru?
Well, I mean, I think there are two stages of this. The first stage was basically 1992 to about 1995, when Montesinos' role was most clearly related to counter-subversion and counter-terrorist activities. And in this context, there are at least two extremely serious human rights crimes for which he's considered directly responsible. One of them was the kidnapping and murder of 9 students and a teacher from the University La Cantuta in 1992, and the other was a massacre in 1991. Both these crimes have been attributed to a death squad which was allegedly created by Montesinos. Then you have the a situation in 1995 when Congress passes an amnesty which leads to the release of members of the death squad which were implicated in those crimes. Following that, you have Montesinos directly involved in a series of actions intended to intimidate the opposition and prevent a movement against Fujimori's re-election. And so the last 5 years of the 90s, more or less, you could see Montesinos playing a clear role as Fujimori's right hand, as it were, involved in intimidation of opposition journalists, phone tapping of opposition politicians, a movement to remove control of the opposition press from the owners of newspapers and television stations, a whole series of actions essentially aimed at procuring Fujimori's re-election this year, in the elections this year.
In terms of the opposition now and what the possibilities are, how do you see this unfolding? What are some of the biggest concerns now that there seems to be a vacuum that has been created, although, like you mentioned, many of the military commanders who were placed there by Montesinos and Fujimori they still are in power. How do you see this unfolding? What are some of the scenarios that we might be seeing?
Well, I think this is a tricky question, because I think the opposition is going to be increasingly divided over whether it's best to go with Fujimori for the rest of the time before the elections are held, on the grounds that the presence of Fujimori as head of state, even though he becomes increasingly a lame duck president, is a better alternative than the instability that could result from a kind of interim caretaker government. Especially when it's known that very powerful group within the armed forces, are basically hostile to this whole process of democratic transition. So I think there will be a division there, because equally a strong section of the opposition are thoroughly opposed to the idea of Fujimori remaining in power, and consider that this will simply be, a recipe for further manipulation of the game by Fujimori to try and preserve, if not his role in a future government, at least protect himself from investigations and secure himself impunity. I think the opposition has to face some very, very challenging questions in the coming weeks.
We know that human rights workers in Peru and others, grassroots movement, have constantly for the last 10 years, and certainly for the last 7 or 8 years since 1992, been talking about a government that is characterized first and foremost by repression, by human rights violations. Is it your sense that this is ultimately what has brought down this regime, if in fact this regime is crumbling as it seems to be, that the human rights issue was such that it the pot boiled over, so to speak?
Yes, except that I think that it's probably slightly misleading to think of the human rights issue as the most important issue here. I mean, I think that in terms of massive gross violations of human rights, these have definitely declined over the last 5 years or so. Indeed, as the threat from terrorism has declined, and what we've seen in at least the last 3 years or so has more been a systematic violation of political rights directed at the political opposition, rather than human rights violations committed in the context of counterinsurgency, which is what characterized the earlier period. So it's not quite as simple as that. I think that what really characterizes this government since Fujimori was re-elected in 1995 is its systematic attempts to undermine the process of the rule of law in particular, and democratic change in the country, coupled with other allegations which have involved especially Montesinos and the SIN in, for example, complicity with drug trafficking and this recent charge of involvement in arms dealing to the Colombian guerrilla groups. So I think it's not strictly accurate to see traditional human rights violations, as they existed in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, as the main factor here.
I guess I also was should have referred to perhaps social and economic rights, the issue of labor rights, the rights of unions to organize freely. What is the situation that has emerged under this government?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to talk about social economic rights. I mean, I don't think that the government has particularly taken any measures that directly affect socioeconomic rights, but one can obviously point to, you know, the great poverty that exists in Peru, and the fact that the Fujimori's policies clearly haven't been successful in terms of employment and combating poverty in Peru. But I don't think you've seen sort of massive attacks on freedom of trade unions or that kind of action.
Sebastian, is there anything else that you would like to add in reflection and as you look forward to this situation unfolding and continue to develop over the days and weeks?
Well, of course, the situation is pretty unpredictable, and it seems to be changing from day to day. But, I mean, I think that this is going to give plenty of room for thought in the future as to the meaning of this whole experience, especially because here we have a situation of a very small clique of people who basically held a country to ransom, virtually by their control of information and a willingness to use information to blackmail people into some kind of co-opt opposition and other people into basically some kind of terrorized silence. I think that the implications for the region as a whole are extremely important because they indicate that perhaps the greatest threat to democracy in Latin America now, it doesn't come from, you know, the traditional type of military coup of the 70s and early 80s, rather from groups within society who are prepared to use underhand methods to bribe, corrupt, blackmail their way into power and use the same methods basically to intimidate the opposition while retaining the trappings of democracy. And this clearly represents a great challenge to the ability of the OAS to actually protect democracy in the future.
Sebastian, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. We look forward to speaking to you in the future.
Okay, thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Sebastian Brett is a researcher with Human Rights Watch for the Andean region. He spoke to us from Santiago, Chile. And we're going to go to some music from Peru right now. This is Manuel Chaprado from a CD entitled Sacra and a track entitled Cuculinay, Celebration.
Yeah. the Toronto Women's Bookstore proudly presents Fall 2000 Author Series. Friday, September 22nd at 7 p.m., Vago Press author Emma Donahue will read from her new novel, Slam-a-lam-a-slam-a-lam-a-slam-a-slam-a-slam-a-slam-a-slam-a-slam. And Saturday, September 23rd at 7 p.m., Random House author Shauna Singh Baldwin will celebrate the paperback edition of What the Body Remembers. On Thursday, September 28th at 7:30 p.m., Canadian Scholars Press author intellectual Hermanni Banerjee will read from her latest book, The Dark Side of the Nation. On Saturday, October 21st at 5 p.m., U of T Press author activist Leo Vasco will support her debut book, Temporary Work. All these events are free at the Toronto Women's Bookstore at 73 Harbert Street at Harbert and Spadina. For more information about these events and upcoming events, which will include Jeanette Winterson, Shani Mutu, Ella Shohad, and Sonia Sanchez with California's hip-hop diva, Medusa. Please call 416-922-8744 or check out our proud sponsor, Now Magazine. This is a Toronto Women's Bookstore and CKLM presentation.
Yo, what's up, world? Yo, this is Big M.A. Uno, M1, know what I mean? Holding it down for Dead Prez. And when I keep my ear to the street, know what I mean? I hear the heartbeat of the people. I hear the working class all worldwide, know what I mean? On word of mouth, let's get free.
Tune in to CKLN 88.1 FM every Monday night at 7 p.m. for Word of Mouth News with Mike Brito. Word of Mouth Mondays brings you the news and views that the mainstream doesn't want you to hear. Joined by regular features, Red Alert Radio, the program of the New Socialists, and Radio Antifa, the weekly feature of anti-racist action, Word of Mouth Mondays is coming with the anti-racist working class perspective. CKLN 88.1 FM, your conscious connection.
The world is yours. The world is yours.
And this brings us to the end of Saturday Morning Live for this Saturday, September 30th, the year 2000. A couple of announcements to make. There will be a benefit show tomorrow, Sunday, October 1st, from 5 to 11 p.m. This is taking place at the 360 Club, 326 Queen Street West. It's a benefit for the victims of the fire last month at Shannon Court, which is near King Street West and Dufferin in Parkdale. It'll be a $10 entry fee. And again, it's a benefit for the victims of the fire last month at Shannon Court. That's at the 360 Club. As I give thanks to Manuel Rosenthal, one of our guests on the show today, Manuel Rosenthal spoke to us about Colombia. He will be speaking coming up this Tuesday, October 3rd, at the International Student Center, 33 St. George. That's from 5 to 7 p.m. It's organized by OPERC Toronto. For more information, 978-7770. That's Manuel Rosenthal speaking on Roots of Resistance, a panel discussion on indigenous land rights. Again, that's Tuesday, October 3rd. And I want to thank Manuel Rosenthal for joining us on the show today. A lot of other people to thank. Sebastian Brett from Human Rights Watch in Santiago, Chile. Professor Michelle Chosudovsky, who spoke to us from Quebec. And also Margelina Ripo, who just recently returned from Yugoslavia. That is the show. Also wanted to say thank you and greetings to Norman Otis Richmond. He interviewed Rachel Manley this morning. Also the folks from Metro Network for Social Justice were with us today. I want to thank all of those people. My name is Pedro Sanchez. You've been tuned to Saturday Morning Live for the last 3 hours. Coming up is The Power Move. I leave you with a little bit of music from the Asian Dub Foundation. What can I say? I'm so predictable. You're tuned to Saturday Morning Live. This is the last couple of seconds of the show. CKLN 88.1. Keep in mind that just a few weeks down the road, we bring you Fun Fest, where we all come together and as a community, make sure that CKLN can stay on the air for another year by fundraising through our 88.1 signal. So make sure you stay tuned for that. Again, take care. Have a good weekend.
Rico attack.
Puerto Rican Obituary, the new release.
Join world-renowned poet-playwright Pedro Pietri for the Toronto launch of the new edition of the acclaimed collection of poetry, Puerto Rican Obituary, an exciting night of New Yorican poetry, theater, and video, featuring El Reverendo Pedro Pietri, New York City poet Nancy Mercado, Tanisha Sribagirata, and video filmmaker Jorge Lozano.
Saturday, October 21st at 9 p.m., The 360 Club, 326 Queen Street West, followed by Music with No Capitalista. Admission is $10. Brought to you by CKLN and CHRY. More info, 929-1834.